The Tom Woods Show, episode 2144.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, if you've decided it's best not to have your kids educated by people who have declared war on you, then consider the self-taught Ron Paul curriculum. Instructors like me will give your kids an unfair advantage and an education you and I could only have dreamed of. But make sure you join through my link, because only there do you get my $160 worth of free bonuses. My link is ronpaulhomeschool.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. First of all, remember I mentioned that there'll be a few odd weeks over the course of the summer where there will be only four rather than five episodes of The Tom Woods Show. Everything is perfectly normal, but that's just going to happen a few times. But in the meantime, if you find yourself in one of those weeks saying, I need the extra content, and you missed episode 2135, you got to go back and listen to episode 2135, because that's when I was on with Viva Fry and the great Robert Barnes on their show, because that's one of the best interviews I've ever given. And I really, really think you'll enjoy it. It was just a great, great, naturally flowing conversation. Really great. So go back. It's a long episode. That should hold you over for part of these times when you have only the four episodes. So tomwoods.com/2135, how to introduce our ideas to a new audience is what I called it. Anyway, today, again, we are in the summer. We're approaching the summer season, but from a child's point of view, it's already the summer because school is out. And we're getting to that point where parents are thinking about the fall. So I want to share with you another lesson from the Ron Paul curriculum. This one is from my course, Western Civilization, from 1493. And it goes 1493 down to the present. And this particular one, I think, has perhaps a lesson for libertarians, perhaps one we don't want to learn, but I suppose one we need to pay attention to. So in this episode, I'm going to talk to you about an intellectual and really more of a cultural movement in the 19th century called Romanticism. And in what you're about to hear, I begin with a review from the previous lesson, which is how I always would do it in the Ron Paul curriculum. And that is, by the way, a great way to make sure you absorb the material. You hear it summarized again the next day, it really takes root a lot better in your mind. And then, by the way, at the end of the week, I do a weekly review. So now you're hearing it yet again, and it really stays with you. I mean, I'm sure you've been like me, where there are a lot of situations where you've just absorbed a lot of material that you just love and you're so glad you know it, but you're afraid it's going to all slip away. But if you just keep hammering away at it, you can kind of make it stick. So that's one of the pedagogical devices we use in the Ron Paul curriculum. So anyway, this lesson, as I say, is on Romanticism. Do not turn it off because the first few minutes are talking about my previous lesson on neoclassicism, because neoclassicism is a valuable backdrop against which to understand the romantic reaction against it, basically. So check that out. By the way, I do make a somewhat sweeping statement about the Enlightenment and religion. And I know there's the Scottish Enlightenment. I was just speaking very generally, and I was probably thinking more about the French Enlightenment. So don't get bogged down in that if you hear me say that later on. But I think you're going to like this. And because there's a portion that does rely on the visuals when I talk about architecture and painting, I've taken most of that out, because you really would need the slides for that. This is generally an audio podcast, but you'll still get a fairly decent background and understanding of what Romanticism is. And then after that's over, I'm going to come back on, and in case it's not obvious what you need to learn from this, all Woods here is going to teach it to you. So here we go. And by the way, you can get this course at tomwoodshomeschool.com, but there are other ways to get it too. You can get it as a free bonus in various ways. So on the show notes page for today, you will find all the ways you can get this course and learn this kind of material again and again and again, with the hundreds and hundreds of lessons just like this one that will help you feel really, really confident being extremely well-educated. tomwoods.com/2144 is where you can find all the different ways to get this course. You can just buy it. You can get it as a free bonus with a couple of different things. There are lots of ways to do it. So having said that, I now turn things over to myself. Hi, everybody. It's Tom Woods, and today we are going to talk about another European cultural movement, and that is Romanticism. But before we do that, of course, we're going to review what we covered last time. Last time we talked about neoclassicism, and remember that in covering neoclassicism last time and juxtaposing the two movements in this way, I wanted to help you
to compare and contrast the two movements, because they are, in important ways, opposed to one another. Neoclassicism, as we saw, is animated by certain ideas like reason and order and serenity and proper decorum, etc. We noted that it was in some ways animated by the science of the day, which was finding the universe to be like a smoothly functioning machine. And this emphasis on the order of the universe pervaded European culture. We see order in architecture, we see it in painting, we see it in musical styles, in following the rules and sticking to conventional ways of doing things. So neoclassicism is reflected in various areas of cultural endeavor. We did talk about painting for some time. We talked about Jacques-Louis David. We talked about the presence of classical themes in painting, that is to say, reaching back to ancient Rome in particular for themes to be represented in the painting. Also, we talked about classical values in artistic expression. So we noted, for example, symmetry. We looked at the Oath of the Horatii, for example, and you've got the father exactly in the center of the painting, symmetrical, so that you've got the men on one side, the women on the other, the father in the center. There's a sense of serenity as opposed to the violent movement that we would have seen during the Baroque era, for example. I talked about, in the case of sculpture, we talked about Antonio Canova, and we contrasted his work on the tomb of Pope Clement XIV with the work of the earlier sculptor Bernini on tombs for two other popes, and you could clearly see the difference. You could see the neoclassical style in Canova, in that it has what some neoclassicals called a noble simplicity. Instead of a lot of color and a lot of curvy lines and emphasis on movement and instability, we have simple horizontal and vertical lines dominating the work. We have more emphasis on serenity. We have a monochromatic presentation, so there's only one color. We talked about architecture. I directed your attention to the United States, where we see buildings that do indeed remind us of the buildings of the classical world, with the pillars and the facade. And we're going to see that that's going to be a little bit different in the Romantic period. The Romantic period is going to take inspiration from other periods, not so much from the ancient world. And then we spoke very briefly about literature, only briefly because you do have a literature course that follows this Western civilization course very closely, and we'll discuss these matters with you further. But here also we see an emphasis on classical allusions. So that's allusion, A-L-L-U-S-I-O-N, of course. And we noted that people, political figures, or people who had political opinions, that is to say, sometimes would write satire in the same form that the ancient Roman satirists would have written it. Or we talked about the work of Samuel Johnson, the great compiler of a very important and influential dictionary. And it's significant that it's in the 18th century that we see this type of linguistic study, the emphasis on the proper use of the English language, grammar books being published, because again, this was thought part of proper decorum, being able to speak properly and to debate and to exhibit wit. This was all part and parcel of neoclassicism. Let's turn now to Romanticism and note that it is a difficult phenomenon to define. And as evidence of this, I note for you that already by the mid-1820s, some 150 definitions of Romanticism had already been offered. So that to this day, scholars have often wondered among themselves whether the label romantic is meaningful at all, or whether it ought to be discarded altogether. I think there is something to be said for it, and I'm going to identify for you a number of themes that I think are reasonable to associate with this movement. All right, first of all, a lot of times when people talk about Romanticism, they say Romanticism was anti-reason. The Romantics were opposed to reason. Now, that's just a stupid position to take. Of course, they're not against reason. How could they make any arguments about anything if they were against reason? So this is, of course, meant to make it seem like all the reasonable people were part of the neoclassical movement, and all the stupid idiots were part of Romanticism. That's not true. It's much better to use Jacques Barzun's description of the Romantic mind, which was the feeling intellect. So they had an intellect. They weren't just idiots with no brains, but they believed that there was more to life than just reason. Like, for example, imagine you're a young woman and you receive a love letter, and the love letter says, "Dear so-and-so, I want to express the love that I have for you. So what I've done is I've drawn for you a flow chart indicating how it originated, the various stages it passed through. And then in an appendix, I've subdivided my love for you into 12 different categories. Each category is further subdivided into 3 subcategories." I mean, you would think the person had completely lost his mind. That's what the romantics are saying. They're saying that it's not that reason doesn't matter. It's that there's more to life than reason. You would be a lunatic to be living your life entirely according to reason. If you were to send that love letter, you'd get smacked in the face. Or, for example, the romantics oftentimes are nationalists. And they would say that nationalism, too, is not based entirely on reason. It's based on a feeling that you have. You have a feeling of kinship with those people who live in your nation. You have a feeling of kinship with those people in the past, in your nation's past, who came before you, your ancestors. You have this sense of kinship that gives you a feeling of pride and happiness that you associate with your nation and your people. Now, no, you could not reduce the love that you have for your nation and people to a mathematical formula. You couldn't put it under a microscope. It wouldn't be scientific in that sense. But does that make it meaningless? That's the type of argument that the romantics would make. Not that reason doesn't exist or doesn't matter or reason is stupid or our whole lives are going to be lived according to emotions and feelings. That's a ridiculous trivialization of romanticism. And I myself do not associate with the romantic movement. I'm not especially sympathetic to it. I think there's some interesting stuff in it, but that's about it. But I just hate when people are mischaracterized. It's happened enough to me, and I hate to see it happen to all these long dead people too. Also, an interest in the distant past we associate with romanticism, because in fact, the romantics are interested in all kinds of strange and unusual and out of the ordinary things, things that are different from what you might experience day to day. So likewise, there's an interest among the romantics in faraway places. And that can be far away both temporally and spatially. That is to say, they can be interested in things that are far away in time, like the Middle Ages. They were very interested in the Middle Ages. The neoclassical period or the Enlightenment, for example, in the Enlightenment, they disparaged the Middle Ages. Everybody was a stupid head and backward and primitive. And that is sort of the conventional wisdom even today, even though historians have tried over and over again to tell people that that's not true. The romantics took a great interest in and had a great respect for the Middle Ages, but also faraway places. They were interested in Asia, for example, which is quite far away. They're interested in different dialects and languages, the diversity of national customs all over the world. They were interested in folk art, the bubbling up expression of national feeling, folk music, the various literatures of different places. So they had a wide-ranging array of interests. We also see among the romantics a willingness to break with artistic conventions. In other words, to do things artistically that were different from how they had always been done in the past, to break with convention, to throw caution to the wind, and to express yourself individually instead of conforming yourself to some existing traditional way of doing things. Spirituality is also a part of the romantic feeling. And so we note that this is to some degree in contrast with the Enlightenment, certainly, and with neoclassicism, where there was just emphasis entirely on reason. Now, I don't mean to suggest to you that spirituality and reason are opposites. I've shown you that in Western civilization, this has not been thought to be the case. The scholastics we talked about in the 13th century are a prime example, but the Enlightenment did think of these things as being opposed to one another. In the Romantic period, there is more emphasis on spirituality. It's not necessarily traditional Christianity or traditional Catholicism, although in some cases it was. But the spirituality of the Romantics could sometimes be based in nature. They were just so overwhelmed by the beauties of nature that it had a spiritual effect on them. But as I said, it could also be traditional religion that affected them. But again, even here, they would be affected by traditional religion, not because of something they read in books that convinced them that that religion was correct, not because of scholastic logical arguments that would prove to them that one religion was true and one was false. But the emphasis was once again on individual experience, what the individual felt. One of the great religious works of the Romantic period was a huge book that I've read myself by a man named Chateaubriand, a French writer, of course, called The Genius of Christianity. And what he's doing in that book is showing how Christianity influenced so many aspects of life in Western civilization. It's an incredibly diverse array of areas of human achievement that he credits Christianity with influencing. And because it's so diverse and it jumps from one topic to another, and it's not a kind of a systematic neoclassical enlightenment style scientific overview, but just here's this, here's this, here's this, here's this, and Christianity is at the heart of it, and it's this animating principle. This is something that we associate with Romanticism. The Romantics, among two of their qualities, as we've seen, were a love of nature and a love of history, things that are old, things that are different from their own world, contributed to pushing forth a respect for the religious sense. Because, of course, religions are old, or the religion of the West anyway, the primary religion of the West, Christianity, is quite old. So their interest in history will dovetail with their interest in religion. And then also, as I've said, they get a lot of religious inspiration from their love of nature. And it's at this time that the philosopher Spinoza from the 17th century, who had been thought of as being irreligious, is now going to be resurrected as a religious man. He'll be portrayed as a religious man because he saw God throughout nature. He came to spirituality through his experiences with nature. Likewise, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who worked primarily in the late 18th century, Rousseau had a work called Emile, in which he found God in the works and beauties of nature. All right, let's say a little something about music. And at the top here, I've got innovations. We do see some innovations in music. That is to say, a lack of just simple conformity to the traditional rules. I mean, on the one hand, you do see the sonata form that we observe, for example, in the first movement of most symphonies, really being codified in the 19th century. So that is a set of rules. But on the other hand, we do see an expansion of what's acceptable in music. For example, instead of four movements, we have some symphonies that are going to have five movements. Like, for example, let's see, Beethoven's Sixth Symphony, the so-called Pastoral Symphony, has five movements. The Symphony Fantastique of Hector Berlioz, which we're going to talk about in a minute, has five movements. So you have that. You have the use of a choir. You have a choral symphony in the case of the fourth movement of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony with the so-called Ode to Joy. So there are new things going on. And of course, there's an emphasis in some of this music on, well, the individual, on his emotions and feelings as expressed in music. There is going to be emphasis among some musicians on nationalism, that is writing music that incorporates, let's say, themes from traditional national folk music. And we've already seen that nationalism is a part of Romanticism. The two are identified with each other, and it makes its appearance in music. Beethoven really straddled both periods, neoclassical and romantic. But certainly you can see, if you were to listen to the difference between, let's say, a symphony by Haydn. I mean, Haydn composed over 100 symphonies. We associate him with the neoclassical period. Compare that to a piece of music by Tchaikovsky, for example. And the Tchaikovsky piece is going to be far more evocative in an emotional sense, whereas the Haydn piece will be very technically impressive, but it won't be meant to evoke the emotional response of the listener. Beethoven also pioneers what's sometimes been called program music or programmatic music. But program music we see, for example, really only in several of his works, but the best known example being the Sixth Symphony that I mentioned a moment ago of Beethoven, the so-called Pastoral Symphony. This is a symphony, when I say program music, I mean that the composer tells you what the music is about. Like, you don't have to guess at it and come up with your own interpretations. He's going to tell you it's about this. And each movement, he's going to tell you this is about this, about this. So the Pastoral Symphony really is about nature and man's response to nature. And, you know, there's a storm, and then there's a period after the storm. So that's something that's new. That's a brand new thing, where the music is not just going to be just music, but it's also going to be, in a sense, a story. Well, I think the best example of this is from 1830, the Symphonie Fantastique by the composer Hector Berlioz. Berlioz was absolutely infatuated with an actress named Harriet Smithson, and he kept writing her love letters, and she hardly knew how to respond to this guy, and he was sort of left out in the cold for some time. He does eventually marry her, by the way. Eventually, they do get married, and the marriage fails, and they split up, and he nevertheless, although I'm pretty sure he finds another woman, he supports her the rest of his life, but he was absolutely infatuated with this woman, and this seems to have been the inspiration behind the Symphonie Fantastique. Now, this is program music. You can find, and if I'm not too scatterbrained, I'll link to you on this page with this lesson on it, the actual words that Berlioz uses to describe the different movements. There are five movements, as I said, and throughout this symphony, we hear the same musical theme making an appearance over and over again. Throughout all the movements and at different times, this musical theme keeps coming up. This musical theme represents this woman, and it keeps cropping up to emphasize that she is constantly on his mind. It's like a fixed idea in his mind, or in French, an idée fixe. And this idée fixe, I'm going to have a YouTube on the lesson page where you can click on it, and a very famous conductor named Leonard Bernstein is going to talk to you about, just for a few minutes, about this idée fixe, and he's going to have a flute player play it for you on the flute. So I don't really need to reproduce it for you, but if I can do this from memory, and I remember thinking when I first studied this symphony, I remember thinking, I don't really like this theme. Like, this is supposed to represent the woman, it's supposed to represent his longing for her, and yet it's, I think it's not that good, but that's just my own personal opinion. But it goes something like this. Da da na da na da 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 na da 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 da. Na, da, da, da. So it's something like that. I think at the very end, I think I might have added a little bit extra that's from just one of the movements, but you get the basic idea of this idée fixe. So it begins, you know, he first catches a glimpse of her. Then there's in the second movement, he sees her at a ball. And you can tell that they're at a ball, not just because you read in the program that movement number two is the ball and he sees her at a ball, but also from the music. It's a waltz kind of music. So you can tell it's a dance going on. So you hear a typical 1-2-3, 1-2-3, that's the signature of the waltz. You hear that in the second movement. You hear da 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 da. Now, that's a obviously very classic waltz kind of music. And then again, in the middle of that waltz, you're going to hear da-da, 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 da. You're going to hear that idée fixe again. And it's going to happen again and again. Now, as the symphony goes on, it becomes weirder. He is just overcome with this woman, and he is increasingly feeling that she's rejecting him, that his love is going to be unrequited. And by the time he gets to movement number four, things have become extremely bizarre indeed. He dreams that he has murdered his beloved. And in this feverish dream, he imagines himself being marched to his death, being marched to the scaffold where he is to be executed by beheading. And as a matter of fact, as he's being marched there and he finally reaches the scaffold and they're going to put his head down, there's a moment where the music quiets for a moment and he catches a glimpse of her, because you can hear da 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 da. You can hear that idée fixe again. He catches that glimpse of her, but then you hear boom, doom, like this. And that's his head being chopped off. And then you hear doom, doom, doom. That's his head tumbling away. And then it's da da. And then the movement comes to an end. Well, then you think this can't get any crazier. The fifth movement is called Dream of a Witch's Sabbath. Now he's imagining these horrifying witches who are coming to his funeral. And in this movement, you hear a parody version of the Dies Irae, which was a very traditional piece of music that would be played at a funeral, at Catholic funerals. Dies Irae, Dies Illa, and then et cetera, et cetera. Well, you can hear it in the symphony. You can hear dun, 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 dun. This is how you know it's a funeral. Anybody in the 19th century would have recognized that as the Dies Irae. Well, then he catches a glimpse of the beloved, but she's now one of these twisted, macabre witch figures. So instead of hearing this beautiful, lyrical Ide Fix, it's now being played using the very strange and unusual sounds of the English horn. And so instead of da 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 da, it's sort of like, absolutely bizarre. I mean, you should probably get yourself a copy of it and just listen to it. It's not my favorite symphony of all time by any means, but it's a very, very interesting piece of music. And obviously you can see how romantic it is. Not romantic in the colloquial sense of he's in love with a woman. Romantic with a capital R in the sense of romanticism. It's all about him, the whole symphony. It's all about him and his passions and his desires and his fixations. That's what it's all about. It's not just about, look at this technically beautiful piece of music that I wrote. It's all about me. He is all over this composition. And that's what makes it a romantic composition. All right, let's turn to architecture now. And here, one of the major themes that we see, one of the major movements that was part of Romanticism in terms of architecture was the Gothic Revival. In the previous course, Western Civilization to 1492, you can see a series of slides of Gothic cathedrals. So we talked about Gothic cathedrals, and in a few moments, I will refresh your memory, or for those of you who didn't take that course, I'll show you for the first time a slide of one of the cathedrals we talked about then, just to refresh your memory regarding at least what the Gothic cathedrals looked like, if not getting into all the details the way we did in the previous course. But Romanticism was very interested in the Gothic style and in reviving the Gothic style, whether in religious buildings or secular buildings, that is, buildings that were not related to religious worship. And this is a reaction against neoclassicism. Neoclassicism viewed the Gothic style as backward and barbaric and something to move away from. We want to replace it with the classical style of ancient Greece and Rome, hence the term neoclassicism. The Romantics, though, looked at the Gothic cathedrals and thought, these are beautiful, they are moving, they speak to the human spirit. This is something that, of course, would be very appealing to the Romantic mind, and they think it's a travesty that the Gothic tradition is being shunted aside by neoclassicism. So they want to bring it back, hence the Gothic revival. So, for instance, in Germany, work on Cologne Cathedral had ceased in 1560, but now in the Romantic period, you begin to hear calls to finish it, and finally work on it begins in 1823. So that's part of the Gothic revival. Carl Friedrich Schinkel, 1781 to 1841, was an architect and painter who had been a classicist, but who was also a devotee of the Gothic style. He himself designed and built Gothic churches. And for example, one of his painted works is Gothic Cathedral by the Water. You can see it here. You can see this cathedral obviously dominating the landscape. And he's looking to show that the Gothic style was not barbaric, but was the very epitome of beauty and was and had a fundamentally German character to it. So we shouldn't flee from it. We should embrace it. Now, in literature, I'm going to let, again, the parallel course that runs alongside this one do most of the heavy lifting. But you'll want to be familiar with names like Goethe, Coleridge, Byron, Blake, Wordsworth, Chateaubriand, whom we talked about briefly, and Victor Hugo, of course. A lot of people know of him from Les Miserables. And of course, the novel continues to develop during the 19th century. Mary Shelley has a very well-known novel, Frankenstein. And here, I want to just let you know that if you're familiar with the Frankenstein story that you would have seen in the movies, chances are you're not familiar with the story that she was telling. The Frankenstein monster, who is created or reanimated from dead tissue by Dr. Frankenstein, is portrayed in the movies as a mute, stupid, but dangerous monster. But her novel is quite different. In her novel, the monster is capable of brilliant soliloquies, meditating and philosophizing about his unique predicament as a being brought back from the dead. He is shunned by society. He is shunned by his creator. He is sent out into society. Everyone can barely stand to look at him, so he lives in isolation. And as you read, I don't want to ruin it for you in case you do read it someday, but as he's sitting there, he finds a place to live where he can see at a distance a small family, and he observes the comings and goings of the father and the older children, and he comes to love these people from a distance, and he thinks to himself about when is the right moment for me to present myself to them and say, I can help you in all the various tasks that you need. He finds sorrow when they're having sorrow, and he finds joy when they're having joy, and he can't wait. He thinks, you know, they'll be able to look past my hideous figure, my hideous countenance, and they will welcome me as a friend. Well, needless to say, that is not how it turns out. So this is a man who, as typical of a theme in romantic literature, he's trying to make an emotional connection with other human beings. And that's in large part what this story is all about. It's not about some monster running around terrorizing people. He demands to know, how can you, my creator, do this to me? It's actually quite a compelling story. And of course, it fits right in with the romantic period, which places such great emphasis on the individual and on emotion and feeling. So that's romanticism, and that's the end of this week. Thanks for watching.
All right, folks, before I tell you what I consider to be, maybe you'll find this anticlimactic, but it is important, okay? It is important what the lesson for us as libertarians out of all this is. Let's get down to business for a second. And speaking of business, some of you run businesses, and some of you are getting buried by your competition online. And a great way to solve that problem is to build your brand, your reputation, and your lead flow with digital marketing by Persist SEO, a great sponsor of The Tom Woods Show. If you're a small local business, you're trying to compete against large companies in the service industry, you can increase your visibility with Persist SEO. Or if you have very few or no leads at all coming in on a consistent basis, well, website search engine and conversion optimization can help move the needle to a more prosperous business model for you. And if you hate cold calling, who doesn't? Use your website as a lead generation engine. If you're not showing up for your services on the search engines, well, get found with expert search engine optimization from Persist SEO. All you have to do is call 770-580-3736 or visit them at ineedseo.help for a free website audit and consultation. That's 770-580-3736 or visit them at ineedseo.help. All right, let's talk about what you just heard. First of all, I apologize for my bad singing and for all my attempts at reproducing various pieces of music, but I'm doing my best with what I've got here. I think a lot of us in the libertarian world, we're kind of logic people. We're like Spock, basically. You know, everything is logic. Everything is reason. And there's nothing, I mean, this is not anything to be ashamed of or feel bad about. Reason is the characteristic feature of human beings. So we should have no shame in placing great emphasis on it. But I think a lot of times we get really frustrated because we feel like we have the best arguments by far. You listen to the kinds of arguments that are winning out over ours, and it's immensely frustrating. Who could possibly fall for this ridiculous argument? And so we just try to argue even harder, and we argue even harder. We've got all the data, we've got everything. And yet we just can't seem to make progress. And I think the answer can be found a little bit by thinking about what I just had to say about romanticism. Is that for most people, reason may not be the primary motivator. And that's not to say they don't use reason at all, but it may not be the primary motivator. So for instance, when the folks at the Sound Mind Creative Group released their definitive documentary on the response to COVID, they're going to feature in there not just the charts and graphs, not just the scientific arguments, but also vignettes from people's lives, the lives of people who had their day-to-day affairs thrown into complete turmoil, people who lost businesses, who lost fortunes, who perhaps lost family members in non-COVID-related areas of health that were deprioritized because of the COVID hysteria. And there's a point to all that, which is that for a lot of people, it's going to be those stories that resonate with them. You can show them all day long that none of the mitigation measures, so-called, did any good. You can, you know, you can argue that if you like, and you're not going to get anywhere because it's just not the way they think. It's not the way they come to conclusions. But if you can tug at their heartstrings and say, look at what happened to this person right here, that for some reason just does a lot better. If you look at the success of somebody like Donald Trump, was Donald Trump successful because he had the best arguments, because he was in full command of all the data and all the information? Not at all. In the debates in 2020, he was asked about critical race theory and he could barely define it. I mean, he knew it was bad, but he could barely define it. DeSantis wouldn't have had that problem. He would have known exactly what to say. He would have been completely up on it. Trump wasn't, and yet it didn't really matter. And that was true in 2016 also. Somebody like Hillary Clinton could know all the statistics, this one and that one and this one and that one, and all he had were a bunch of platitudes. And yet he won and she lost. Why is that? Now look, I'm not particularly good at that, making visceral appeals to raw emotion. That's not really my thing. I'm good at making arguments and being logical and marshaling statistics, as I think many of us are. I'm not so good at stirring the heart. I can do that in a speech here and there, but that's not the backbone of where I'm coming from. I'm coming from a world of data and study and knowledge and propositions on a piece of paper, and I just keep throwing that at the world, and sometimes the world is resistant to that. And it's not necessarily that my arguments are bad. It's that sometimes I'm trying to make arguments to people who don't really respond that well to arguments, but they do respond well to things that appeal to the kinds of things I was describing in the material on romanticism, that do make plays on emotion and the heart and feeling. These kinds of things can move them. And then it's true, they can use reason then to garner information to kind of support conclusions that they've reached on the basis of feeling. But that's where the conclusions many times come from. And if I'm not remembering this wrongly, I'm pretty sure that's kind of how David Hume thought about it. And I don't say that he's right all the time, but that in effect, you kind of know what you want. You kind of know what the outcome is going to be on the basis of, you know, what your passions or emotions or feelings tell you. And then you kind of reason backwards to manufacture rationales to support what you already want to believe for more gut reasons. And unfortunately, that is the way it seems to work. This is why people who are great filmmakers, who really, really do move people, can have a real cultural impact, because those films are not PowerPoint presentations with charts on them. Those films with the visuals, the music, the dramatic performances are meant to stir the heart, the emotions, the feelings. And so we are in this situation where I think so many of us who belong to this movement think like one kind of person, but most of the people in the world are another kind of person. And somehow we've got to come to terms with that. All right, everybody, remember there are about 400 videos of the sort you just heard today, video and audio, so you can listen on the go if you don't want to watch the screen and my slides, but covering almost every topic under the sun in the history of Western civilization and in government. And you can consume this and become really, really, really knowledgeable, such that you can be obnoxious at dinner parties. And I know we all aspire to that. But honestly, I mean too that you won't have that feeling that maybe you'll be discovered, that actually, if anybody ever asked me about X, I would have no idea what X even is. Or, I know there were paintings in the Renaissance, but that's about it. I can't say anything about it. All that will be fixed for you. Okay, no more feelings of insecurity, or if only they knew how little I know. No. I'm going to get you right up to speed super fast, and I'm not going to have you bored to tears. So how to get these courses, tomwoods.com/2144. See you next week, everybody.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.